From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. On the final day of a virtual summit on climate change, President Biden said tackling global warming would also be good for the economy. And he said his $2 trillion American jobs plan to rebuild infrastructure beyond roads and bridges was the way to do it.
When we invest in climate resilience and infrastructure, we create opportunities for everyone. That's the heart of my jobs plan that I proposed here in the United States. It's how our nation intends to build an economy that gives everybody a fair shot.
And just days after the guilty verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle say they're actually getting closer to agreeing on police reform. And the GOP is looking to South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, the only Black Republican in the Senate, to lead them. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now to talk through all of this. Rick Klein is political director at ABC News, and Aisha Roscoe is White House correspondent for NPR. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Republican Senator Tim Scott, who has said he feels optimistic about the prospects of Congress passing a police reform bill. Let's listen.
I think we are on the verge of wrapping this up in the next week or two, depending on how quickly they respond to our suggestions.
Okay, we'll get to the details of that reform bill in just a moment. But first, Scott is not only the lead for this legislation, he'll also be giving the GOP response to President Biden's speech to Congress next week. Scott is not a household name, Aisha. What are some of the reasons Republicans have picked him to lead?
Well, in many ways, he has done what was almost impossible during the Trump time in Washington, is that Tim Scott, as the only Black Republican in the Senate, has been able to walk this line where he has not always agreed with former President Trump, but he was able to make some criticisms, especially when it came to issues of race, but still remain on his good side and still be viewed as loyal. So he's been able to, and when it came to the George Floyd killing and the protests after, Scott was the one who took the lead on coming up with some policing legislation from the Republican side. He has been a voice that has been able to get some credence and not necessarily completely polarizing. And so he's been able to shore up support from the base, but also from kind of the establishment Republicans. And so at this moment, it seems to be that is what the Republican Party is responding to by putting Tim Scott out there.
Okay, it sounds like he's able to walk that line. Let's break down a little of what's in this bill. In the past, lawmakers have stalled on stripping police officers of qualified immunity, which protects them from lawsuits. Rick, what specifically might Congress get passed on police reform?
Well, it's possible that the qualified immunity be extended to police departments rather than individual police officers. That might be enough to solve this. But this has been a major sticking point in the past, and there are many thorny issues. I'm frankly surprised by the optimistic tone that it's not just Senator Scott, but even some of his Democratic colleagues have taken in the wake of the Derek Chauvin verdict. I think there's a broad recognition about what that case and what the death of George Floyd highlighted about police tactics. We've seen so many high-profile examples, and it may just be that that is the impetus for the additional discussions that are necessary. There's lots of reasons to be pessimistic these days, but I think there are reasons for optimism to say that there are areas of police tactics, of oversight at the federal level, of regulations and guidelines that could come from the federal government that could actually be helpful in making this a productive moment as opposed to just a matter of pure tragedy.
But Rick, not a lot has changed in the year since George Floyd has died. I mean, in the past week or so, we've seen several more police-involved killings around the country. It's interesting because this is an issue that wasn't really right at the top of President Biden's priority list when he took office. Where do you think it is now?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you're right, it wasn't, but he talked about the racially motivated rioting at Charlottesville as an impetus for his candidacy. And broadly speaking, The way that he launched his campaign and the way he framed his candidacy, even through his rescue by Black Democrats in South Carolina, for his candidacy was basically dead in the water before that comeback. It is wrapped up in the broader politics of race. And in some ways, you could say, as an establishment white Democrat in his late 70s, he seems ill-suited for the moment. But in other ways, the promise of unity, the way that he obviously naming Kamala Harris as his running mate, the charge that he's given as attorney general, some of these areas suggest that this is something that he's going to take on in a bigger way. Now, how does he prioritize it when you've got so many other big issues around infrastructure and the environment and so much else all around the 100 days? That is a big question. But it may be that the deals that have to get cut will happen or not happen with or without him at the congressional level. He will gladly provide whatever impetus he can from the White House.
Okay, Aisha, on the issue of infrastructure, yesterday Republicans put up an offer, $568 billion as a counter to President Biden's infrastructure plan. It focused on things Republicans want to focus on, traditional infrastructure like roads and bridges. Here's Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito yesterday.
We're ready to sit down and get to work on this. I think that's probably the biggest biggest message we want to put forward is that this is important to us.
The last Republican counteroffer on coronavirus relief was pretty much ignored when Democrats pushed their plan through without any Republican support. Do you think this one on infrastructure is going to be any different?
It is not. It is, Democrats have said that this is way too low. So this in and of itself will not get traction if it's going to be the only thing. Unlike with the coronavirus aid package, though, there does seem to be more time.
It sounds like we might have just lost Aisha.
Yeah, Rick, why don't you pick up that question if you could?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you look at the price tag, and it's large by historic standards for Republicans, but it's only a quarter of what Joe Biden has said is necessary to address these issues. And maybe more importantly, it rules out the idea of raising taxes on anyone. It keeps intact all of the Trump tax cuts, including the corporate tax cut. So unless there's some give on the pay-fors and maybe some give on the scope, I don't know that there is compromise here. I think that there are deals to be cut, but they're just so vastly diminished from the definition of infrastructure and the outlining of the need that President Biden has put forward that I don't see him doing it. That said, they don't have the votes right now. And the reason that he has the negotiating window open is that Democrats need to open that window. They need Republicans to come on board. They don't even have all the Democrats on board for the Biden plan, even as he's putting more meat on the bones in terms of additional spending that he'll be outlining in his speech next week.
Aisha is back with us. I want to ask you about something else. The White House press secretary would not confirm a New York Times report that part two of President Biden's infrastructure plan won't include healthcare expansion or prescription drug coverage. What do we know about this next plan, which is due out next week?
Well, they have been somewhat cagey about how they're going to, put this plan out. Now they say that they're going to do it on the big speech before the Joint Congress that President Biden will outline what's going to be in this next part, which they are calling the families part. This is supposed to be the part that's going to be more on the quote unquote human infrastructure. It's supposed to be focused on people. So like care work and things like that, how people are able to, do their work by being able to have caregivers and things of that nature. So that is what this next part is supposed to focus on. But we are still waiting for more details on how they're actually going to put it all together and what's actually going to be in this part of the bill.
You know, before we let you go, we only have about a minute and a half, but I want to ask you guys, this is Climate Week. This week, Biden proposed to cut U.S. greenhouse emissions in half in just 9 years. By 2030, he's saying, as part of the Paris Climate Agreement that the U.S. has now reentered. There weren't a lot of details on that plan, though. Rick, what is the big takeaway from this week's climate summit?
Well, it may be easier to get the world on board than the United States Congress. I'd say that in part lightly, but the fact is that these goals look better and sound better as broadly stated ones. But once you get into the details of what it would take, we don't know a lot about how you do this without congressional intervention. And Congress is signaling on the Republican side almost no interest in taking this up, almost mockery of the idea of these goals. So I think Biden is being applauded for his boldness. And there's lots of good words coming from the international community. But the follow through here at home is going to be critical here. And we're just not seeing any evidence of the political climate changing around that.
Aisha, you want to take the last 20 seconds and give us your thoughts on how this week went with climate?
The administration is arguing that they are on track, and experts say that the U.S. is on track, but they have to speed up very much. So those investments are going to have to come from somewhere if you're going to move the U.S. away from fossil fuels.
Aisha Roscoe at NPR, Rick Klein, ABC News. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
More people are dying of drug overdoses. 2020 saw a 30% increase in deaths here in the U.S., more deaths, according to the CDC, than during the height of the opioid epidemic. And one addiction that has proven difficult to treat is methamphetamine. Meth grips the brain in a way that no other drug does. And so far, no medications or therapies have been proven to treat the addiction to it. But a series of new treatments and intervention called contingency management, or CM, are actually showing promising results. Let's bring in Dr. Dominic DeFilippis. He's a clinical psychologist at the Corporal Michael J. Crescens Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Philadelphia. And he's been leading the study on the CM program there, where patients pull reward slips, as they're called, with either money or words of encouragement from a fishbowl for every clean urine sample they provide. Doctor, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Yes. So could you briefly start by describing how this intervention works?
Sure. Well, contingency management is an evidence-based treatment typically applied to people with substance use disorders. And what CM does is it embraces the idea that to displace a behavior like substance use that provides immediate reinforcement that is very, very compelling to the user, you have to try to make recovery behaviors, for example, abstinence from substances, immediately rewarding as well, so that the patient can choose those behaviors and receive that immediate reinforcement and increase the likelihood that those abstinence behaviors or recovery behaviors will increase in likelihood and frequency.
Mm. But what is it specifically about methamphetamine that makes it such a difficult addiction to treat? What does it do to the brain?
Like all substances, methamphetamine or stimulants in general, their key point of action in the brain is the area of the brain that uses the neurochemical known as dopamine, which is sometimes referred to as the pleasure chemical, because the action of dopamine in the brain is associated with the psychological experience of pleasure or feeling reinforced. What the effect of methamphetamine and other stimulants is to cause a great release of dopamine in the brain and keep it in the brain, keep it active in the brain in that gap between the neurons known as the synapse, keep it in the synapse a long time so that there's an intense and lengthy experience of pleasure. Mm. And because of that intense and lengthy experience of pleasure, the patient is compelled to continue the experience by repeatedly self-administering the stimulant drugs.
And you actually found in a study you did in 2018 that you had great success with initial trials of CM, which tried to break both meth and cocaine addiction. You found that 91% of urine samples came back clean during this type of intervention. There's also a promising new study published in January that detailed a two-medicine regimen for treating meth addiction. We mentioned earlier no medication has been approved yet, but how important is the medication aspect to breaking the cycle of meth addiction?
I like to think of effective treatments as using an all-of-the-above strategy, because there's likely not going to be a singular treatment that is effective for all. What I'm looking forward to are studies that look at the combination of psychosocial treatments and medications to see if we could push the envelope, if you will, on an even greater effect and a broader effect with a broader swath of patients.
Hmm. You're now gathering data on the long-term efficacy of CM, but the intervention is now used throughout the Veterans Affairs healthcare system. What are the steps in rolling this out nationwide to those who really desperately need help in the wake of this pandemic?
That's a great question. And in VA, the work I'm involved in is actually a national clinical implementation. Now, outside VA, there are some challenges to implementing CM, for example, resources to support the incentives that would be used to reinforce behaviors like abstinence or attendance. The model of CM we use in VA, it's known as PRI-CM, sometimes goes by the moniker Fishbowl CM because patients earn draws of prize value slips from a container, typically a plastic fishbowl. Well, what I do know is that certain caps or limits on the amount of incentives that a patient can earn can render CM an ineffective treatment.
Before I let you go, I want to ask, what's been the response from the patients you're treating? You've seen their battle firsthand and the efforts to rebuild their lives.
I'll give you a little vignette of a patient, an actual case of a patient who was in CM, and he wrote a letter, handwritten letter to his CM provider. And in that letter, and of course I'm paraphrasing, he said, you know, when I first came into treatment, I really felt kind of angry that another adult was asking me to provide a urine sample. And I felt, boy, this is humiliating. I'm being asked to, using the patient's term, pee in a cup for someone else. Mm-hmm. And after being in CM, I found myself racing through traffic, running down the halls to find my CM provider so I could provide a urine sample and actually earn the reinforcement for my abstinence.
Mm. Well, doctor, thank you so much for telling us more about your work and your findings. I really appreciate this conversation.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
We will be following the Academy Awards ceremony on Sunday. We want to know who wins Best Picture, Best Actress, Best Actor. But you know, there are a lot of categories that get less attention, like Best Sound Editing. We radio nerds actually love that one. But even during the golden age of radio back in the 1930s and 40s, the artists creating the sound effects were often overlooked, especially when it came to the lone woman in an industry dominated by men. Katie Sewell of Bittersweet Life podcast brings us the story of Ora Nichols.
It's no secret. Radio in the early days was a man's game. Men were the directors, the producers, the composers, and the sound effects technicians. But there was a woman who greatly influenced the sound effects profession. Her name was Ora Nichols. She led the CBS sound team that brought the famous War of the Worlds broadcast to life.
Wait a minute, something's happening. Some shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from that mirror. It strikes him head on. Lord, they're turning into flames.
Ora Nichols was the first and only woman to run the sound effects department during the Golden Age. Ora and her husband Arthur are even credited with bringing the entire concept of sound effects to the radio. They were the first two people ever hired for the job. The couple loved inventing and creating sounds. They originally used this passion to score silent movies, but as radio emerged without sound effects, the need for their talents became obvious. You can hear how sound effects bring a story to life, if you consider radio without them.
Wait, Buff, listen.
Good night.
Hey, come on, folks. Whoever's in that rocket ship that crashed out there is going to need help.
Now here's the same scene with Aura's sound effects.
Wait, Buff, listen.
What under the sun is it?
Look here, out of the window.
Look. Good heavens, Wilma.
Good night.
Hey, come on, folks. Whoever's in that rocket ship that crashed out there is going to need help.
You can certainly hear the difference. Radio's very first science fiction radio show took off with jets that Ora invented.
Buck Rogers in the 25th century!
Ora modified an air conditioning unit to make that sound. And she used a lot of common objects in her work. She discovered an egg beater sounds a lot like a lawnmower. She opened alien spacecraft doors by by twisting a cast iron lid.
Hey, look, it's a Martian ship.
Right. See, the metal door on the side of it is open.
Today we consider Ora Nichols a pioneer in the field of sound effects. But being the first sound effects woman came with challenges. Actors and directors were still learning to value her trade, as much as they valued their own. A conflict between Ora Nichols and this man is still remembered.
All that happened before the arrival of these monstrous creatures in the world now seems part of another life. My wife, my colleagues, my students, my books, my world. Where are they? Did they ever exist?
That's Orson Welles performing War of the Worlds. Ora worked with him frequently, and there was ongoing tension over how sounds were created. Take that egg beater, for example. Ora knew from experience that it sounded more like a lawnmower on the radio than an actual mower. Orson thought that authentic sound could only come from real life. If that meant covering a studio in grass and mowing, he'd insist on it, then be angry when it didn't work. The final straw came when Orson called Ora a screwball in front of her entire crew. She had had it. Ora threw down her headphones and walked out. No one had ever walked out on Orson Welles, and certainly never before a live radio broadcast. He was shocked, and he was humbled. Ora demanded a public apology. He gave in, and she returned to work.
The sooner we can get that giant disintegrator going, the better our chance of saving them.
Sound effects today are so commonplace, artists can win awards for sound design. But Ora Nichols earned her place in history. Today, she is considered one of the most influential women in radio for pioneering and legitimizing the sound effects profession. For Here and Now, I'm Katie Sewell.
In stressful times, you want to spend your time checking out not just what's best, but what's best for you. We know you care about what you watch, what you read, and what you listen to. NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast is with you 5 days a week to make sure that time is well spent. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
When people make money from selling a stock or any other kind of investment, the government takes a cut of the profit. It's called a capital gains tax, and President Biden wants it to go up to raise cash for his new economic plan. His idea is to double the tax for people earning $1 million or more. And good luck finding a Republican who's going to support that idea. Let's bring in Mike Regan. He's senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, good to speak with you again.
You too, Peter.
I just laid out the broad idea there behind capital gains taxes, but tell us more about how they work.
Well, like you said, Peter, it's really any investment. You know, we hear a lot about this with regard to the stock market, but it could be anything from, say, selling a family business to selling a fine piece of art or a big chunk of real estate. And the capital gain is basically the difference between what you paid for that asset and what you sold it for. And that profit is what you're taxed on. I think the one really thing that's important to point out about this is how few people in the U.S. this will actually apply to. My colleagues here crunched the numbers, and it's less than 1/3 of 1% of American taxpayers will actually be affected by this higher rate due to the high threshold of income needed to meet it.
And we got to point out, too, that capital gains are usually taxed at a lower rate than regular everyday income, which some people think is sort of a tax break for the rich. Why is that?
Well, so the argument in favor of the lower capital gains tax rate is that it encourages investment in entrepreneurship, which in turn could create jobs, lead to better economic growth, better wealth creation. You know, but like any political debate that touches on economics, there's a lot of debate about whether that's true. And, you know, many people on the other side of that argument will point out that some of the most innovative companies in the U.S. were actually founded when capital gains taxes were much higher than they are today.
Okay, so that lead up is to make the point that Joe Biden, the president, wants to double the capital gains tax. What's his idea?
Well, the idea is there's, you know, we've gone through this pandemic. There were a lot of programs that the government funded without really paying for. That's causing the deficit to get a lot bigger, causing the government to take on a lot of more debt. So it's clear that there's going to be pushback in politics to start paying for some of these initiatives. And this increase in the capital gains tax would raise about $370 billion over a decade to help pay for some of the goals he has, such as reducing child care costs and making pre-K and community college free. So it's kind of a pushback against the deficit hawks who say we can't spend any more on programs without it being funded.
The stock market investors didn't like this news. It fell when it leaked out. Republicans are expected to put up a pretty united front against any Biden proposal to raise taxes significantly. So what are its prospects?
You know, so it's definitely not going to be a rubber stamp approval in Congress. I think that swing vote of Joe Manchin is going to be really important. And a lot of the Wall Street analysts I'm reading are suggesting that it'll probably get compromised down to about, say, 28% capital gains tax for the highest earners.
Mike Regan is senior editor for Bloomberg News. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you, Peter.
It is the final day of National Park Week, which we're using as a somewhat arbitrary excuse to talk about nature. Emily Pennington tried to visit every single one of the country's 63 national parks last year, and she made it to all but two. Emily joins us now. She's Outside Magazine's online parks and travel columnist. Emily, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. And how'd you come up with this idea of visiting all the parks in a pandemic, no less?
You know, if I'm being totally honest, I think like with many big adventures, the idea started after a breakup. Many years ago, I dated an Eagle Scout who introduced me to the great outdoors and took me on my first backpacking trip. And then I noticed that when that relationship had ended, I found myself returning to those same natural spaces and particularly the national parks. So it was kind of interesting that the thing that hurt me ended up being the thing that provided the path to healing. And so I figured if the parks had given me so much on a personal level, then why not take a year out off and go see all of them in a year? And then lo and behold, it ended up being 2020. It was the year that I chose.
You ended up flying, I'm gathering, to Alaska instead of driving there because it's remote and there aren't roads everywhere in Alaska. Let's just spend a little time on Alaska because I saw your video in a little plane above Glacier Bay National Park. And oh my gosh, Emily, it was stunning.
That park was one of my favorites. And also that was my first park in Alaska. And I got so fortunate because I got to see the glaciers from above rather than from a boat, which is how most people experience the park. And like you mentioned in that video, you can see these like 400 foot tall, just electric turquoise blue crevasses poking up out of the earth. And you can literally see the Tidewater glaciers melting down from the mountains into the ocean. And our pilot was telling us that just in the 20 or so years that he's been flying, he's actually personally seen three or four of the most famous glaciers recede from the water. So now they're just kind of up on land. And so the effects of climate change were really evident.
Wow. What kind of trouble did you get into along the way?
What kind of trouble? Oh, gosh. One of the more harrowing moments, especially since we're on the subject of Alaska, was the one big guided trip that I decided to splurge on was for Kobuk Valley and Gates of the Arctic National Park, because the logistics of getting a bush plane and actually backpacking into these parks that have no roads or, you know, any medical services if you do something wrong, the logistics were just so crazy that I decided to go with a guide. And thank goodness for it, because about 3 or 4 days into a 6-day trip, I started developing a fever and my throat hurt really bad and I couldn't sleep for 2 days. I had to hike out like 8 miles off trail with my giant pack on. with our guide. And then by the time we finally got to a doctor in Fairbanks, we found out that I was developing scarlet fever, but we caught it just barely early enough.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know people even got that anymore.
Yeah, I didn't either. I thought it had gone, you know, wayward in the 1700s, but no, it is a real disease that you can get. And I have no idea how I caught it because no one else on that entire trip got sick. It was just me for some reason.
Wow. And in the middle of a COVID pandemic, you get scarlet fever. That's amazing. I'm glad to hear that you're doing better. Now, I guess one of the reasons I asked you that question is because in your reporting, you've actually done a piece where you point out that it's not uncommon for tourists to die in national parks. Not to be morbid, but 134 people have died in the Grand Canyon since 2010. Tell me more about that and the dangers that people face when they're in these areas.
Yeah, the Grand Canyon is actually, I think, one of the more interesting parks on that list that recently came out, because falling isn't the number one cause of death in the Grand Canyon. I think where people really get into trouble is they hike down in the morning, maybe when the temperature's a little nicer. And a good rule of thumb is that the temperature raises, I think, 3 to 5 degrees for every 1,000 feet down that you go. So at the very bottom of the canyon, it can be up to 110 or 120 degrees. And then it's the afternoon, the sun's baking you, and you have to hike all the way back uphill to get back to your car or wherever you're staying that night. And I think that people get themselves into trouble because they think they can do the whole thing in a day, and they can't. So a lot of people, unfortunately, die of heat stroke or heart attacks or dehydration and other things that are considered quote-unquote natural causes.
I've done that twice. I've gone up and down in the canyon twice in my life, and it's 17 miles, and you're right. It's even in, you know, February, there's snow on the top. You get down to the bottom, it feels like you're in the desert. And there's signs all over the trailheads that say, don't do this, it's too dangerous. But obviously people do. You got to be very, very careful. What other problems is the park system facing right now, budget-wise, climate-wise? What else did you notice?
Well, one thing that was really exciting that passed, I believe in October of last year, was the Great American Outdoors Act, which allocated funding for, I believe, $11.2 billion of maintenance backlogs that the parks had amassed over the preceding decades. And another thing that was really a clear issue last year was the catastrophic wildfires in Colorado and California and Oregon and Washington. I personally got stuck in Seattle for 4 extra days just waiting out the smoke in a cheap motel room. And the sun was this apocalyptic orange and the sky was like this brown, foggy haze, and you couldn't go outside. And I think that there's going to be a big conversation about park management and how to maintain natural ecosystems while also making sure that they're not so fire prone as climate change intensifies.
You know, the national park system is so iconic in this country. It's like an important part of the cultural fabric for many people. What did you learn through all of this about the land and our country itself by making these trips?
The biggest thing that I learned was how to lean into the void, because it's so rare in the city that we get to feel as small as we do in these natural spaces. Traveling through so many wilderness areas for 12 months really showed me that if you can't lean into discomfort and chaos, you're going to end up like this really rigid ball of nerves. And if you can let go a bit and kind of sink into that scary void that nature can often present, it teaches us a lot about resilience and personal strength that we can then take into our city lives.
I hear that. Real quick, before I let you go, I had mentioned you almost made it to every one of the parks, save two. Yes. Which were they?
Well, one of them isn't my fault because New River Gorge is a new national park that was not on the original list. Right. And the other one is American Samoa, which is way out near New Zealand and Fiji. So hopefully if they do vaccine passports, I'll make it out there a little later this year.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not going to blame you for not making that one. Emily Pennington. It sure is. Emily Pennington is Outside Magazine's online parks and travel columnist, writing a book about her travels to America's national parks. Thank you. I'm jealous. I'm inspired. I'm all of those things. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
We want to take a moment to remember the oldest living person in the country. Her name was Hester Ford. She died on Saturday at 116 years old, according to her family. And she was deemed before her death to be the oldest living American by the Gerontology Research Group. Ford was born on a farm in South Carolina and grew up picking cotton. She married John Ford when she was just 14 years old. And they later moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, where she lived for the rest of her life. Hester Ford lived through more than a century of history, including the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. But this current pandemic didn't stop her loved ones from celebrating. For her 116th birthday in August, they held a drive-by party. Ford was also a woman of great faith. Here she is at 111, reciting Psalm 23.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures.
When she was asked about her longevity, she simply said the Lord wasn't ready for her to go yet. Over the weekend, her great-granddaughter, Tanisha Patterson Poe, spoke to WCNC in Charlotte.
She wanted the best for everybody. She wanted people to have the type of faith that she had, to be able to believe that anything is possible.
Hester Ford had 12 children, dozens of grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and at least 120 great-great-grandchildren. What an extraordinary family legacy. This Sunday, Pastor Patrick Anguolo will give his first sermon since the conviction of Derek Chauvin for the murder of Pastor Anguolo's friend, George Floyd. Anguolo is the pastor of Resurrection Houston and became friends with Floyd several years ago, before Floyd moved to Minnesota. And we spoke with him about this last summer and the impact of Floyd's death.
I think we're at an inflection point in our nation's history. And I think George's death serves as that. In the words of the scripture, we're going to master this sin of racism, or it's going to master our country. Those fault lines have been there since the country's inception, and I just think it's coming to a head.
Patrick Anguolo is lead pastor of Resurrection Houston and joins us now. Pastor, welcome back to Here and Now.
It's my pleasure.
Yes, Pastor, you joined us just over a week after George Floyd was murdered. And at the time, you were grieving, understandably, trying to process the pain of your loss. How are you today?
I'm fine. And on the cosmic to-do list, I think the issue of the verdict is closed, but the task of justice is still open. And until all my brothers, grandfathers, and sons can breathe free air in God's paradise on earth, we still have work to do.
Mm. I'm thinking about the message you're going to give to your congregation this weekend on Sunday. It'll be your first Sunday service since the conviction of Derek Chauvin. Is that part of the sermon that you will be giving to your congregants, this task of justice ahead?
I think it will. And then also we will be explaining to them, you know, how it all connects, that, you know, if peace is a circle, and when that circle has been broken by either sin or immorality or injustice, if you will, justice is what closes that circle. I mean, what do you do when what was taken is not money? You can give money back, but what do you do when what was taken was a life? And I think that the Christ story, it provides answers. A Palestinian Jew is slaughtered at the hands of a government that enacted state-sponsored terror and humiliation by crucifixion. This Palestinian Jew, is Jesus Christ. God reverses that death sentence and raises him from the dead. We call that resurrection. We call that justice. And so in the case of Brother Floyd, we hope when he is raised, he'll receive justice. And those of us who are still here, we can continue that process of resurrection, that recreation process that God started when he raised Jesus from the dead. That resurrection gives us hope that one day in America, justice will roll down like waters and righteousness will roll down like a mighty stream. And it provides us the motivation for us to keep pressing on, even if we lose our lives.
Hmm. I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, George Floyd has now become a symbol of something greater, our country's reckoning over racism and police brutality. But he was also a son and a brother and a friend to you. How will you remember him outside of this tragedy?
I will always, etched in my mind, always be grateful and thankful for his hospitality, his warmth, his kindness, him being that gentle giant that opened up doors in the community that I wasn't native to. But because of, I mean, his, man, just excellent hospitality, we are still seeing the benefits of that relationship in 2021. I just remember him as a great soul. And even if none of this had happened, it's a testament to who he is as a person that God would probably use him. And it's a great testimony, I think, to the idea. So many people think that faith is all about perfection, but I think the Christian faith is about redemption. And here's God redeeming this man.
Pastor, what is your message for those, though, who are feeling weary?
Yeah, what's interesting is in that same story of brutalization at the hands of state-sponsored terrorism, formerly called the crucifixion, there was a three-day pause. There was a Friday, a Saturday, and part of Sunday. And in that pause, there was weeping, there was lamentation, there was grieving on the behalf of someone who was killed, because often we rush on to Sunday, but we forget that there were 3 days for people to pause and to grieve. And I think the resources that are provided in the scripture help us to see that we ought to pause and to go through the grieving process and lamentation process. And it's okay to be angry. But as the writer would say, weeping may endure for a night, but joy definitely comes in the morning.
Patrick Angulo, lead pastor at Resurrection Houston. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.